This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look at our feed archive for Sunday night and Tuesday afternoon releases, or visit baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hey everybody, welcome back to another spoiler podcast edition for episode 505 of HBO's Game of Thrones television series. Brought to you, of course, as always, by Bald Move. You can find all of our content at baldmove.com. First, I got to issue a correction slash retraction slash clarification about Barristan, because I confused a lot of you when I talked about him last week. And I mentioned that Barristan dies with Kraz at the end, but then 30 seconds later I said, but we still know he's alive and kicking in the books. I don't know why I said died. It was just a brain fart. But I did not mean to imply that. Yes, we from everything we know in the books and also in the leaked previews, released preview chapters for The Winds of Winter, Barristan the Bold is very much alive and kicking in Meereen. And we've got some interesting tinfoil at the end about that. So stay tuned for some of that. I apologize for kind of making him Schrodinger's sell me, having him both alive and dead in last podcast. I also want to talk about that scene with Aemon and Jon. I kind of made a sly reference in the main podcast about that, but I thought it was pretty funny from a book reader standpoint. Jon walking into the room and getting the camera's focus just as Aemon says, "What a terrible thing it is to be a Targaryen and alone in the world." I thought that was pretty delightful. Also, if we put our book binoculars on and look ahead, they're clearly laying the framework for Sam to go to the Citadel, talking about where there's the majority of the books and how Sam's always had this desire to be a maester. I think, you know, obviously, some people are said, well, maybe they'll just Martin's razor that part of the plot out. But I don't know, because we know that there is at least one Sand Snake, the Sirella slash Arellus connection that we talked about in last season's tinfoil cast about the possible what Jaqen's up to and possible Jaqen identity theories. We know there is a lot of stuff going on in the Citadel, something that's important into the research of magic and dragons that might kind of blow this whole scenario wide open. And I doubt that they get away from doing that with the TV show. Could be wrong, but they've got to remix that some way, because Martin clearly thinks it's important. And unlike some of these other things like Quentin Martell and John Connington and Young Griff and Aegon and all that stuff, I don't know that they can kind of reduce that any more than it already is. So they need, I think, Sam to go to the Citadel to achieve some purpose later on in the plot.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
However, I'm wondering how they'll rationalize sending Gilly. You know, maybe as simple as Sam saying, "I can't leave Gilly here alone with all these rapists and thieves. I need to take her with me." Melisandre is not at the wall, so don't have to worry about her trying to, you know, burn this child of hers, which was the reason they sent her off, the protector and her child, they sent her off from the wall in the books. So I don't know, because as much as I want to see, you know, in my quest for penile equality, I want to see Sam rocking his fat pink mask and getting his first sexual experience with Gilly, I'm having a hard time seeing how they'll rationalize sending her off on the boat. Maester Aemon also, as they've talked about him being in poor health and sick, it would be interesting if he just calls an audible with Jon and being at Hardhome saying, I need to go to the Citadel for some reason before I die. And he decides to take, you know, Sam and Gilly with her. Maybe the Black Brothers are getting rowdy in Jon's absence. I don't know. I haven't figured that part out yet. I also have a possible Selyse theory, and going back and forth with some emails and on the forums with some fans. I've been thinking about what Jim and I were discussing on the show, which is that they're setting us up on the show for some kind of danger between Melisandre and Shireen. And we know in the books that things get pretty dire on the march to Winterfell for Stannis' forces. You know, the snows start piling on. There's no food. People are freezing to death. I wonder how the hell Stannis, though, would possibly allow Shireen to be burned, especially after that father-daughter bonding moment they had a few weeks ago. You know, there's one possibility, and I kind of alluded to this in the main cast, in a moment of weakness or perhaps some kind of magical manipulation by Melisandre, he allows his daughter to be burnt to save his men. In the books, Stannis looks more and more haggard as the series progresses, which suggests that Melisandre's blood magic is taking a progressive toll on his body and his spirit. Maybe we'll get a scene of some haunted, sunken-eyed, gray-skinned Stannis ordering his daughter to be put to death in like a monotone for the greater good of the realm. Or Selyse, Stannis' wife, makes this suggestion. Because it seems like she's, you know, hates her daughter and is always looking for a way to offer or put her up for the fires. Maybe she tries to pull this shit and it's the last straw for Stannis and he has Selyse burnt instead. I mean, we've got all this talk of king's blood. What's queen's blood worth in the blood magic market anyway? I imagine it's not worth nothing, and maybe we'll find out. That's my pet theory right now. Getting on to the feedback, let's get right to it. Kevin L. Mentions the theory about Melisandre and her possible parentage. It says it's very interesting. It seems plausible enough to me, but I initially was not sure where it fits or if it even mattered. Then in the past episode, I noticed something small which may be support for it. When Selyse negatively mentions that Jon Snow is a bastard, Melisandre became very bristly towards her. Normally, she is nice to Selyse, as if trying to butter her up. But Selyse definitely struck a nerve with Melisandre by besmirching Jon because of his bastardhood. Perhaps she took offense to this because she herself is a royal bastard. Perhaps she feels a bond with Jon because they both overcame their unfortunate birth status to rise to power in spite of their last names. You know, this antipathy between Selyse and Melisandre is one of the things that had my wheels spinning about this burning Selyse theory that I just laid out. Other than that, maybe this is the beginning of the hint of an S plus B equals M confirmation on the show. Who knows? We know one thing. Bloodraven is up in the north with Bran. They have a part to play. So does Melisandre. So if they do have a connection in their past, there is a 0% chance that this doesn't make it into the books. This isn't a Roose Bolton vampire lord kind of theory, which may never be proven and yet can never be disproven either. If S plus B equals M isn't true, I think it's going to be obvious before it's all over, because those two are two powerful forces coming in contact. And if it just happens that that's Bloodraven's daughter or, you know, granddaughter, I feel like that's going to come out. I feel like we will get confirmation if this is true. Remy K., can you elaborate more on why there are so many tinfoil hats and theories about Howland Reed? I do not recall in the books what a significant role was, and sadly only remember mentioning of him by his children and stories told to Bran. Well, it's nothing that's really buried, Remy. Ned Stark and Howland Reed are not only very good friends and mutual supporters, but they are also the last two people on Planetos that were left standing on the assault on the Tower of Joy. Now, if you recall my discussion of R plus L equals J, you'll know that the Tower of Joy is the tower where Rhaegar hid Lyanna Stark away during the rebellion, and where Ned found her on a bed of blood. She was protected by Sir Arthur Dayne, Sir Oswell Wint, and the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, Gerald Hightower, three of the biggest badasses in Westeros at the time. Ned Howland and five other stalwart Northerners managed to defeat the Kingsguard, but just barely, because the other five didn't make it. So if you subscribe to the R plus L equals J theory, that means that Howland is currently the only person left alive that we know for sure is aware that Jon is the son of Rhaegar Targaryen. Now, book readers have impatiently awaited Howland's appearance in the story. Other than sending Jojen and Mira Reed to Bran to begin his Greenseer training, he's been AWOL this whole time. Which is strange, since you'd think if, again, and, you know, I'm just assuming this theory is true. It's like 99.9% confirmed for me. And especially now that they're playing lip service to this in the show, that might be 99.999. I might get Six Sigma on this shit before this season's over. Anyway, if you take all that, you'd think he'd have some big role to play in the series. Well, if Howland Reed is actually the High Septon, or excuse me, the High Sparrow, that neatly explains his absence, because he's not been absent at all, right? He's directly striking against the heart of all Stark enemies, and ironically subverting a faith he doesn't believe in to do it, which further weakens the Southern lords that he's trying to take vengeance on. So that's kind of why people assume he's important and are looking for him to appear in the story. Daniel T. So now that the show is cutting down on material and condensing, I have some thoughts. The Boltons most likely will be around for a while. Stannis will probably fail and or be killed by Brienne. Let's not forget his evil shadow baby that killed his brother, regardless of reasons or likability now, that probably won't go unpunished. I assume they'll be around a while because if they don't introduce a new quote-unquote bad faction, we don't really have many bad guys left. The Lannisters are a shell of their former self. Jaime's becoming an almost protagonist, and Tyrion has been there a long time. Tywin is dead and only Cersei is left, and she won't last. She has no real power anyway. The Freys are still out there, but they aren't a huge force with big aspirations. Without Lady Stoneheart running around and no Manderlys yet, either, what do we have? We have the Dany nonsense over there that no one cares about. Bad guys around her, but no threat to Westeros. They just want their slaves and her to be gone. We have Jon at the Wall and the White Walker plot. The Wilding threat is over. Littlefinger is running around setting up for something, with Sansa set up to help take down the Boltons. So with Jon being the only one focused on the White Walkers, everyone else is focused on their own power grabs. The only threat to the crown right now is Stannis and possibly the Boltons. So who are the bad guys? Is just going to be all the ones we like fighting to the death for the crown until the White Walkers become a huge threat? So my response to you, Daniel, is even if this is all true, this is a good thing. We only have two books left, two, maybe three seasons tops left. The whole War for the Dawn, the fight against a teeming horde of ice creatures we don't even understand is in front of us. And you got to ask, you know, talking about the others, how likely is it that Gurm has created a one-dimensional evil force to set against the quote-unquote good guys? I mean, in my mind, it's not likely at all. This guy does not do absolute good and absolute evil. I'm not saying I think we're going to get a Night's King POV chapter or Rotting Ice Corpse number 57 POV chapter or any crap like that, but I do think there is going to turn out to be a lot more to the others than we've gotten so far. They're not going to be just some pure evil alien force we can't comprehend. And I think we got a little bit of hint there last year with their transformation sequence. It was chilling and creepy, but I don't know that it felt evil. I mean, you could argue that these guys were saving this abandoned child. I mean, I don't know. It's we don't have enough information to know what we're up against there, but that's my whole point. We need how many pages to contextualize the threat of the others and what their real motivation are and what they're actually doing up there. You know, Dany still has to tame her dragons. She still has to land in Westeros. Westeros has to unite behind somebody if there's going to be hope to be had. This stuff is all going to take time, namely two more books and at least two more seasons of television. So yeah, we're winding things down and reducing threats, reducing enemies, but I think that's appropriate when we're 5/7 through the plot of the story. We're also forgetting the Dornish and whatever the hell they're up to. I don't believe for a second that Prince Dorne is just going to throw his hands up and give up once he hears that Quentin is a burnt crisp. It's got to be something more going down there at the tip of southern tip of Westeros. You got the Tyrells. And I did not get the impression that Cersei was done fighting either, now that she has Robert Strong on her side. I mean, what, it took 2-3 episodes of a television show to deal with Tyrion's trial, both the trial proper and also the trial by combat. I think Cersei's going to last at least that long, especially if the Clegane Bowl get hype theory is true, that Sandor is going to come down from the north, living with the quiet men on, was it the Island of Sorrows? He's going to come down and fight his brother. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. I believe in the book version of the Gravedigger equals the Hound. I believe that's true. But it could also be just a nice send-off for this character at peace. It doesn't necessarily mean that George is putting him on a shelf to use later. But if that is true, if the Clegane Bowl, undead Gregor versus healed and newly hopeful champion of the Faith Sandor, that's going to take a little bit of time to develop too. There's a lot of plot left. We got to quit. I think it's high time we stop squabbling with all these minor lords and kings and queens and get to that stuff. So there's not a lot of time left. I think we're right where we need to be, even if all that analysis is true.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Moving on with Zach. I've been thinking about the significance of the Lord of Light in regards to Beric, Catelyn, and Brienne's story arc for some time now, and I'm wondering if there are more tinfoil theories out there covering this. Thus far, it seems none of these characters are affecting the main storyline, but have been giving everyone some hope that Stoneheart or Brienne will avenge the Starks in some blaze of glory-killing conquest. Personally, I don't think the Lord of Light cares about the Starks or their fans. My theory is that the Lord of Light has used one of his only vessels in Westeros, Thoros of Myr, to awaken some demon who has been steadily getting stronger and stronger and hopping from body to body to realize some plot that we are currently unaware of. Here are some points that I am considering. I thought it was very strange that Barrett gave his life for Kat by giving her the kiss of life, considering that she was a rotting corpse and has no banners after all. And why on earth did he think that would work? With that knowledge of how this quote-unquote gift works, it makes me wonder if Barrett just wanted to kiss some rotten corpse and he unexpectedly killed himself in doing so, which serves him right for being a necrophiliac. Maybe this would make more sense if there was a demon inside him that knows how these rules work and wanted to inhabit a body that is arguably a step up from Barrick in terms of power and recognition. Barrick tells us he's getting weaker and weaker every time he dies, which is another way of saying the demon inside of him is getting stronger and stronger. When we see Stoneheart, it seems the demon is almost in absolute control. When we see Breen at last, the scene is quite creepy, although Jaime comments on her face being bitten off. He also says she looks much older. Well, to be fair, a face biting can do that to a person. I assume that she's already dead at this point from the hanging. Moreover, to entrust the killing of Jaime Lannister to Brienne doesn't make much sense if Brienne only said she would do it in the middle of her hanging. Maybe they took Pod as hostage, but is there any proof that Brienne even cares about some random kid? For me, it makes more sense if this demon transferred to Brienne's body after the hanging, leaving Lady Stoneheart a cold corpse once again. This may explain why they've already ditched her story arc in the show. The problem with my theory is even if the demon is getting more and more vicious, his motives are often hidden by the characters he's possessing. Of course Kat wants to go around killing people. Of course Brienne is most likely killing Jaime to save Pod. Either way, I think it would be interesting if the next time we see Jaime, he is awfully creepy looking and ready to kill someone. After all, he has access to nearly any High Lord in the land, including his own sister. I'm not sure of the demon's motives, but taking Jaime's body is most likely a good move. Well, Zach, that is a very novel theory with not a lot of hard evidence, but, you know, as you said in your email that I didn't read this part, you kind of know that already. Jaime being possessed by a demon would be kind of interesting with some of this Valonqar theories of the little brother, the Cersei prophecies, the little brother, which is the direct translation for the Valyrian word Valonqar. It would be interesting from that standpoint. But I want to point out that Gurm himself confirmed back in 2012 at a convention appearance. This is in the So Spake Martin archive, that Brienne choked out the word sword while she was being hung. And he also said her main motivation was sparing Podrick Payne's life. So Brienne being alive and trying to save someone under her protection, because after all, Pod is her squire, I think it's well within her character. I mean, he's not just some boy. Even if he was just some boy, Brienne, her first and last instinct is always to preserve innocent life. I mean, she sees herself as a true knight. I mean, she doesn't call herself a knight, but she embodies those principles more than any of the real knights in the kingdom. So I think that's well within her character, and it's hard to explain from a demonic possession point of view. Also, the Lord of Light is kind of this mythical savior force behind Azor Ahai, who is seen as this figure of good and who saved mankind from the Long Night. Now, on the other hand, Lightbringer, the famous sword of Azor Ahai, was forged in the beating heart of his wife, and the Lord of Light does seem to demand a hell of a lot of human sacrifice for a benevolent deity, so who knows? If I'm honest, though, I think my internal magic eight ball, if I shook it and turned it upside down, would say about this theory, outlook not so good. I think introducing this new demonic force, a literal kind of deity that's possessing vessels on Earth, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of support textually or thematically in the books for this kind of stuff. Not saying it can't happen, just saying that we need a little bit more proof to take it serious. Josh H. says, it certainly looks like they're setting up Ollie to be the Brutus to John Caesar, but do you think the Double D's could throw us a huge curve and leave John unscathed? Maybe Gurm's John resurrection is sloppy and hard to film with various wargings and skin changing, and they decide to skip all that noise and ditch the Night Watch mutiny. I guess with him traveling to Hardhome and back, they could show Bowen Marsh and Sir Alistair twirling their mustaches and pouring poison in Ollie's ear, but I'm not quite sure they'll go there. Or perhaps they will still want to give everyone the cliffhanger that the book readers felt, and he will be badly wounded at Hardhome. I'm guessing this is where we'll see Rattleshirt again, and it's entirely plausible that that situation could sour quickly. So, what you really have to ask yourself, Josh, is are the Double D's afraid if they don't kill John, that a bunch of book readers won't surround them in cloaks chanting, "For the books!" Because that's what I think would happen, to be honest. I think that, you know, from what I've seen of, you know, the change to only your sister, to the change of fetch me a block, from some of the other changes, that there would be riots in the street if he doesn't have the Black Brothers kill John. So, I mean, I think there is some things I like here, like Rattleshirt. I think we'll see Rattleshirt again. He's unaccounted for in the show. He's a very recognizable, visually distinct villain, and if the plot requires any kind of skullduggery or any kind of sedition within the Wilding Army, any kind of shit to break bad between them and the Black Brothers, even if it's someone else entirely in the books, which it would have to be since Rattleshirt got the Royal Mance Raider treatment in the books, Martin's Razor suggests that they would just reuse him. I also think him being wounded in Hardhome, John, not Rattleshirt, John being wounded in Hardhome is just a far less interesting plot point than a Black Brother rebellion offing him Caesar style. So, to me, that's the Double D remix seems to be using Martin's Razor to eliminate extraneous plots and extraneous characters. This is just change for change's sake, and if that's the case, it's the biggest change for change's sake they've ever made, and I don't know if I like it. Moving on from Sean from Kansas. I was thinking which characters could show up at Winterfell near the end of the season for the Ramsay and Sansa wedding. The Brotherhood Without Banners? Possibly, with Gendry in tow if he ever got back to them after leaving Dragonstone. It takes a long time to row from Dragonstone to Winterfell, y'all. I'm just saying. In the books, it looks like the Brotherhood is preparing to infiltrate the upcoming Frey wedding at Winterrun. In the books, it looks like the Brotherhood is preparing to infiltrate the upcoming Frey wedding at Riverrun, but that storyline is likely gone from the TV show. Or maybe they show up in Winterfell. So I'm not sure why you think the Frey wedding won't happen. I think it will. It's just going to happen in next book and thus probably next season. But back to your email. The Blackfish, Brendan Tully. They made a point of clarifying that he escaped the Red Wedding, but he hasn't been seen since. In the books, many assume he's in hiding, protecting Jean Westerling, which is Rob's wife in the books, who may have become pregnant. But in the show, wouldn't it make more sense for him to try to protect or save Kat's daughter? You know, I've been saying the Great John would make a really great Lord Manderly replacement, but goddamn if the Blackfish wouldn't be even better. He's a Riverlander, so the whole North Remembers rhetoric isn't going to sound the same coming out of his mouth. But shit, they already had Ramsay say it, and that just about made me vomit. Maybe the Great John and the Blackfish joined together as some kind of grizzled old man badass duo. I think that would be pretty cool. The Great John showing up at Winterfell for the Stark-Bolton wedding makes a lot more sense because he's a Lord of the North. The Blackfish showing up openly would be a harder sell because I would think Roose would just execute him on sight, right? The other Northern Lords have to kind of swear fealty to Roose while he's got the dominant position in the North. So I can see Roose, you know, he's like, I got to lead these guys. I can see him allowing those people. He has to. I mean, you're going to throw a wedding for the North. You got to have the Northern Lords there. Blackfish doesn't make that invite list. He continues, will Wald or Frey be there? And if so, there's no way he gets out of Winterfell alive. And I agree, which probably means he won't be there. He continues, Asha Greyjoy, will she make one more attempt to rescue Theon, or is that storyline dead? I think it's dead. But then again, I think that about all the Greyjoys save Theon. And also having saying that, what is dead may never die. I think they threw in the rescue attempt last season, honestly, solely to show us, the audience, how utterly broken Theon was. And, you know, I guess also to kind of pay off the Asha Theon stuff from before. I don't know. I'm kind of grasping at straws there. I guess it makes sense because you didn't know that he was truly broken until you gave him a credible escape attempt from someone he knows and he trusts and would absolutely know it would be loyal to him. And it looked like it's successful. And what does Theon do? He locks himself up rather than go with his sister. That showed us unquestionably that Theon was a broken, broken man and had no fight left in him, at least at that point. So I think that's it's a done deal. I think the Greyjoys are dead until they come up from the water spit and salt. So we'll see. Chris from Kentucky says, I just don't buy into R plus L equals J theory. He's one of the 0.00001% that doesn't believe it. He's not Six Sigma on this. I think John is the son of Ashara Dane and Brandon Stark. Ooh, that's a good one. I actually almost did that for the tinfoil this week. I'm pretty sure the Ashara Dane, the A plus B equals J theory is going to be coming down the pike as alternate R plus L equals J theories later this season. So stay tuned to that. Continuing with Chris, he says, I would still give him some fire and ice blood since the Danes have Targaryen blood in them. I think Dany is the savior for the realm and the son of Rhaegar and Lyanna. I think Jon will be resurrected by who we believe is the quote-unquote Night King, but it's really Jon who is the Night King. It's Jon Snow who will lead the others into the battle for the realms of men. It's Dany who will save them with the help of the other Targaryen, Tyrion. So Jon resurrecting as evil, or at least vengeful, like his stepmom, Kat, is a very popular theory. But as I discussed in the main podcast, Dany being evil is another popular possibility too. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the Night King was a Stark, the first and original Night King. So this would have a lot of symmetry to this. And if he hadn't burnt Ygritte's corpse, I'd think it'd be even more possible, since a white version of Ygritte would have been an awesome Night's Queen counterpoint to the Night King, which, according to legend, the Night Queen was responsible for subverting the old Lord Stark commander in the first place. Jon being an evil Ice Lord with Dany opposing him with Dragonfire would also work thematically in the terms of ice and fire playing out too. A lot of people think that's, you know, Jon and Dany marrying and ruling forever and ever. Song Ice and Fire could just as easily imply that they're in opposition. It's an equal and opposite force. Jon could be the good guy and Dany could be the fire and blood conqueror that needs to be put down, or vice versa. Or they could team up. Or they could both be evil, and then the realm's fucked. I mean, that's a whole, what is Martin playing at that I was trying to get at the last podcast? We don't really know whether we're in for a good ending or a bad ending, but there'll be more for more of that discussion of that topic next week on the main cast. Oisa now A, I still don't know how to pronounce your name. If I'm butchering it, please, next time you write in, give me a pronunciation guide. They start out, I like what they've done with Stannis, even though his character is slightly different from the books. But I kind of wish they'd shown a quick scene of them giving an order for the mining of obsidian to start a Dragonstone, like in the books, to show that he was taking the threat of the White Walkers seriously. Ugh, agreed. That scene would have worked so much better if Stannis had just clapped Sam on the shoulder and said, I'll dispatch a team of men to start a quarry for Dragonglass immediately. Your books might be far more important than winning the upcoming war than your father's blade. It's super annoying to me that they made Sam, you know, this Sam is kind of awesome moment combined with the Stannis is a great leader moment. And they made it into something that made them both look obtuse as hell. Like, I don't think they consider them obtuse, but the way they just kind of drag this revelation and kind of it going anywhere makes them both seem, you know, like the Springfield Police Department from Simpsons. They just, you know, thumbs up their ass, heads up their ass as well. She continues, or he continues, you continue. I also very much enjoyed Sansa being placed as the outsider to witness all of this brewing tension in the Bolton household. And while I do understand the need for the showrunners to gradually develop Sansa's character into whatever she needs to become, just like they did with Jon and Dany, I do hope that they are smart enough to give her enough agency so it doesn't seem like she's reverting back to her old ways. I totally agree with you once again. I am over Sansa being the victim. She has to contribute, and in a major way, to her liberation, or I'm going to be pretty fucking annoyed. That's why I'm a huge fan of the Chekhov spike theory I mentioned in the main cast last week. The fact that she's got that chain choker she's always wearing, it's got that long-ass metal spike at the end, and she's constantly fingering it. That's got to be for a reason, right? You continue, for a long time there's been rumors that there's an upcoming scene in this season that will be very uncomfortable and hard to watch involving the actors who play Ramsay, Reek, and possibly Sansa. For a long time I have been, and still am, worried that it could be a similar scene to what happened with Jean Poole on her wedding night in the books. However, after Roose's reveal about Fat Waldo's pregnancy, I'm hoping in a weird way that has more to do with her demise, with maybe Sansa being a witness to it rather than the other way around. Man, I would strap in for at least a heavily implied Sansa rape scene with Theon being complicit, like in the books. It's going to be gross. It's going to be uncomfortable. And the way they're talking about it, I think we need to prepare ourselves mentally and emotionally to witness that. Now, having said that, here's what I hope happens. Ramsay orders her to strip down naked. He's about to claim his bedding rights. He orders Theon to get her slick as a baby seal for him, just like in the books. But then Theon finds his metaphorical balls, puts his foot down, and refuses to humiliate Sansa in this way. That has Ramsay start on viciously. He starts in on Theon, starts beating him, whatever, turns his back totally to Sansa, not even considering her to be a threat. Sansa sets her jaw, grabs her spike, and shoves it right in the base of Ramsay's skull as the Stark theme plays triumphantly. Who says no to that? Anybody? Done deal. Let's make it happen. Come on, Double D's.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcasts, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Hunter W., I hate to keep bringing it up, but I hate Bran being cut out of season 5. It just doesn't make sense, and it'd been perfect to cut to him the scene after Ramsay made Reek apologize to Sansa for killing Bran. What are your thoughts on cutting Bran out? I'm afraid they're leaving him out, hoping they can wrap up A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragon all remixed up and hopefully not step on the Winds of Winter's footsteps too much. I'm even more afraid that, like many storylines in book 4 and 5, that Martin has dug himself into a hole and is going to wander until he can figure it out. Well, we're not going to get Bran. That's been pretty much confirmed. I don't know if you heard on the podcast, but there is a bird's eye scene of the broken tower looking down on Sansa and Miranda, and there's actually crows crowing in the background. Or cawing, or whatever the hell, squawking, croaking, whatever the hell they do. And that kind of POV has kind of been reserved for like brand's vision type stuff. And I wonder if they're hinting for us book readers that Bran is keeping an eye on what's going on in Winterfell, which we know he does in the books. So even though we don't see Bran, we might be set up for like a beginning season 6 flashback sequence of Bran ensconced in the tree roots with his eyes rolled back and he's just showing white and he just has these flashbacks of everything he's seen from the crow's eye perspective. So even though we don't have Bran, we will have Bran in retrospect. Does that make sense? I'm still worried about, you know, Isaac growing up and being 7 foot tall and what that's going to look like. But on the other hand, we've also had a year to forget all that stuff. And if they, you know, get rid of Saruman the Dingy and give us a really honest to God, three-eyed crow, blood raven, withered root coming out of his eye, badass, I will forgive it all. He continues, stop me if you've heard this one before, but where the hell are the White Walkers? I know it's a running joke throughout the books and the show, but aren't we overdue for a glimpse or a creepy scene to finish the episode? If I'm not mistaken, we haven't seen them since the baby was turned last season. Yeah. The White Walkers have been gone. In book terms, they've been gone a hell of a lot longer. Like, we got that scene of going way north in the land beyond winter or the winter beyond lands or whatever it's called. We don't get that in the books. That's actually new show information. So it's been a long time. And I think that's kind of deliberate. You know, we're like all focused in this Game of Thrones, which ultimately isn't going to mean shit when these guys come and march on the wall. So I kind of think it's intentional to establish this threat and then kind of lull us to sleep with the Storm of Swords and the Clash of Kings and the Meereenese Knot and all that stuff. We kind of fall asleep and forget about these people. So it'll be shocking. We can all kind of be shocked along with all of Westeros when they rear their scaly, icy heads. Finally, he says, sorry if this has been asked in your previous cast. I can't remember it, but I've only been listening since season 4. Has the show ever explicitly shown Arya or Jon's power to warg? I feel like it's important to the overall story, but I also feel like it's late to reveal for show watchers only. P.S. would love to hear the tirade Jim has if they reveal Jon can warg after he appears to die. He would hate that shit. I don't know, because we know that the Starks have the warg power. I've certainly mentioned that enough to establish it, and it's not a new thing. I think what drives Jim crazy is when something just when you need it appears and you don't know. It's not based on anything. I know he wasn't really crazy about the guy being resurrected. I don't know. I can't explain why he does like some things and doesn't like others. It kind of only makes sense to him. So I don't know about the whole flip his shit, flip tables, whatever, on that possibility. But to answer your question, I've always thought in season 2, episode 4, when they show Rob's invasion and the beginning of the Battle of the Whispering Woods, that we are intended to see the POV of Grey Wind to be Rob warging into him. You know, the way you compare that way, that shot with the way Bran warms into Summer. I think that that's intentionally and kind of a nod in the show. So we already have kind of one confirmation. It would be fairly easy, and in fact, I think it's going to be interesting when Arya gets blinded, assuming she does get blinded, for her to start demonstrating warging powers. I think it's kind of hinted in the books that at least part of her being able to cope with the blindness is her learning to warg and to compensate for that. Also, being robbed of one sight lets her concentrate even subconsciously on working this other gift. So I think we might be in for some of that. We might be in for some of her having some of these wolf dreams of Nymeria attacking the Freys on her behalf. You know, maybe we'll even see Nymeria tear the throat out of one of the people on her prayers. I'm trying to think of who one of those would be that would be vulnerable in that position. Certainly not Walder Frey. But anyway, that's a possibility. And I think when it comes time for Jon to warg into Ghost, or however they decide that, that they could set up, you know, stuff with camera tricks, showing Jon's eyes, showing Ghost eyes, that they could visually explain what's happening in a way that I think most people will catch up and keep up with. So It doesn't worry me that they haven't shown other Stark children besides Bran being able to warg. I think they kind of have with Rob, but you know, that was a really subtle thing, and I think we will get some with Arya. Now, on the other hand, if we don't get any of that warging stuff with Arya, then I'm going to start being on the warging is only for Bran in the show, and that Jon won't get ghosted. In fact, he'll just be resurrected by the Lord of the Light somehow. In fact, if I go back to my Selyse theory, perhaps when Stannis has Selyse burnt, you know, I'm just going to run this theory, he has Shireen sent back to the wall protected by Melisandre, or perhaps he just banishes Melisandre because he's overcome with grief and he doesn't want her corrupting influence around his family anymore. Or maybe Shireen is not a happy entirely that Stannis had his mother burned, so she demands Melisandre being sent back to the wall. They got to have something to get Melisandre sent back to the wall so that she can resurrect Jon. And there doesn't need to be a complicated warging plot. She could just breathe the kiss of life into him. Either she dies or he lives or whatever. There doesn't have to be warging involved. So if we don't get any warging with Arya this season, and if Jon is resurrected late this season, early next season without any kind of warging, then I'm just going to say it's canonical for the show that only Bran can warg, which is stupid, but whatever. Nicole D. There was a leaked filming picture where we saw what looks like Jorah fighting the fighting pits with Tyrion sitting next to Dany watching. I think Dany judges Tyrion for his family's crimes or his own. He demands trial by combat, and Jorah, knowing he's about to die from grayscale, fights for Tyrion. Well, Nicole, I've got a treat for you. Kevin S. from Seattle sent me a link from Reddit, which I actually already read, but he prompted me to actually consider this for the tinfoil of the week. This is the first. This is a tinfoil first. This is show-derived tinfoil. This is a tinfoil crackpot theory based on stuff we know from the books, but primarily influenced by the changes in the show. So I thought we'd change it up. And half of this comes from a guy named CryptorChild92 on Reddit, and about half of this is stuff that I've extrapolated or supported based on his original theory. So, let's start off. We're all on board with the Jorah equals John Connington. He is literally playing the role of John Connington, or the part that we need John Connington to play. It cuts out the middleman. It gets Jorah and Tyrion together much quicker. It eliminates a potentially confusing and, I suspect, ultimately amounting to nothing Aegon, a landing plot in Westeros. It gives us a vector to spread a wide-scale disease of Meereen without adding any new parts, like the Pale Mare, which amounts to dysentery, which nobody wants to see. Thousands of extras shitting their pants and getting the bloody flux and all that stuff. Give them grayscale. It's something to recognize. You can see it on their faces. You can see the people moaning in the streets. It's going to be a shit show. So, and I know. Grayscale takes a lot longer to spread. On the other hand, grayscale in the show can do whatever the hell they want. It could be like the Walking Dead zombie virus. You could come back in 15 seconds or 9 hours, just how whatever the plot demands. So there we go. Jorah equals Jon Con. Done deal. This theory, called Jorah the Explorer, which I thought was pretty funny, goes a lot further than that. Could Jorah replace both Euron and Victarion Greyjoy, for example? Let's consider. Jorah and Tyrion are currently somewhere in or near the ruins of Valyria after escaping from the Stone Man. In the books, Euron claims to find his horn, Dragonbinder, in the ruins of Valyria. Is it possible, in traveling through the ruins of Valyria, for Tyrion and Jorah to discover some ancient dragon horn? Maybe Tyrion has heard of such a thing in all of his reading, and he recognizes the mythical artifact. Hell, there's even a hint in the show. Tyrion says, "Are you going to bring Daenerys a souvenir from her ancestral homeland in case I'm not enough?" Jorah says, "You'll be enough, but imagine how much stronger his position will be in her eyes if he manages to recover a dragon horn and it works." Thus, Jorah could replace both John Connington and Euron. But wait, there's more. There's a lot of speculation that Tyrion and Jorah will be captured by pirates because, well, that's what happens in the books. And from the preseason trailers, we know Jorah eventually ends up fighting in the pits. I mean, we all saw that in the trailers. Nicole saw it in the pre-release stills. It's possible that Dany judges him as a traitor and has him thrown into fighting pits to, you know, as some kind of trial by combat, or maybe just to kill him. Who knows? But this would kind of contradict her earlier statement from the episode that only free men would be allowed to fight in the pits. So what if Dany welcomes both Jorah and Tyrion into her council in gratitude for bringing her the horn? I know I'm running with the previous theory, but stick with me. This is tinfoil, goddammit. What if Jorah is sitting beside Dany as she is witnessing the fighting in the fighting pits, like in the books, just like where the poison locust plot comes from? Drogon, having been attracted to the smell of blood and death from the fighting pits, is attracted. He lands in the middle of the fighting pit, starts fucking shit up like only a giant dragon can do. Jorah jumps into the fighting pits, perhaps because he knows he has grayscale and is suddenly reckless in his defense of his queen. He shouts at the great beast, "Me! Try me! Over here! Me!" Jorah has just successfully replaced Ser Barristan. But let's go back and run with the captured by the slavers angle for a bit. What if the slave ship they were captured by has a certain red priest? Or, more interestingly, what if it has a rather attractive red priestess that was giving Tyrion the eye a few episodes ago? A red priestess who sees Jorah's grayscale and decides to try to treat it with fire magic, thus providing him with the red hand of smoky doom. Boom, Jorah has just replaced Victarion. Regardless of how he arrives a Marine, with a smoky red hand of doom, or in chains as a fighting slave, or with honor as the man who brought Dany the key to controlling her children, he's in the pit. He watches in horror as Dany tames Drogon and then alights on his back. That's Drogon's back, not Jorah, to be clear. Although, if Jorah were writing fan fiction, that would be how this would all go down. Anyway, now it's all up to Jorah to handle the harpies, to handle the grayscale slash pale mare epidemic, to handle the threats to Meereen on all sides. He doesn't like this Hizdahr character going around marrying his queen. He doesn't trust him, so he goes and confronts him. Hizdahr isn't going to sit there and take this crap from some upstart disgraced knight, so he shouts to his pit fighter, Kraz, to take care of him. "I'll eat your heart out, bear man," says Kraz. "Then come," says Jorah. Once again, Jorah has put on the shoes of Ser Barristan the Bold and completely replaced him. Later, Jorah, Grey Worm, and Tyrion decide to go down to the catacombs because they decided they want to release the dragons. Maybe because they want to try out their new dragonhorn. Or maybe Jorah is just desperate enough to help his queen and wants to impress her when and if she returns. Things don't go well. Jorah is consumed by dragonfire. Jorah has just replaced Quentin Martell. Now, admittedly, it's a pretty slim chance that he can fulfill all these roles. He's not the Swiss army character of Westeros, or maybe he is, but damn, doesn't a lot of this sound elegant as hell? Assuming that Barristan, Euron, Victarion, John Connington all have an important part to play in the story, why can't he be all of these things? I think the biggest stretch is the Quentin Martell angle, but do you know some boring rich kid who is probably extraneous to the plot at this point? Someone who needs to die to free up Dany to marry someone more awesome? Someone who knows where the dragons are located and might be crazy or desperate enough, or maybe armed with a stolen dragon horn he doesn't understand, something he might have made off with from the queen's chambers as he fled the wrath of Jorah the Bold. Someone desperate enough to hold power in the absence of Dany that he'd be willing to risk a dragon's fire. Someone like Hizdahr Zolorak. Sounds pretty cool to me. So there you go. Some show-derived tinfoil. How's it fit? How's it sound to you? This is a rapidly developing theory. It just came out this week. This is fresh off the tinfoil presses. I'd love to hear your guys' takes on it. Poke holes in it. Elaborate. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how it matches up with the season. But I'm loving it so far. Send all that into GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this with me on our forums at forums.baldmove.com. Take care to note which threads are marked spoilers and which threads are marked no spoilers, because I'd hate for you to start putting tinfoil hats on all the show watchers. That would horrify them. So I'd like to find out what you think about that. You can also follow us on facebook.com/baldmove and on Twitter @baldmove. Of course, you can go to baldmove.com to find all of your content needs, all of your podcasting needs. Pretty excited to see what we're going to end up with this next Sunday and all the Sundays to come. Thanks for being with me for yet another week of tinfoil theories and spoiler speculation, and I will see you next Friday. Until then, I'm Aaron. Have a great weekend.